I spy with my little eye something beginning with E. Want to take a guess, guys?
Enlightenment?
No.
Emacs?
No.
GF?
No.
I think I know what it might be.
What is it?
Ephraim?
Well, that was... Hey. But what we've got at the moment is an episode. It's episode 2 of season 3 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And we do have an Ephraim with us as well. We have Ephraim Hernandez-Mendoza, who's the Linux Format Art Editor, who's never been with us before on a podcast, but he's making a guest appearance today. Hello, Effie.
Hola a todos.
There we go. And in this podcast, we're talking about Ubuntu, Google, Firefox 4. We've got our discoveries of the week. We've got our tablet designs and much, much more to come. If you love this podcast, you'll love our magazine, Linux Format, which you can subscribe to at tuxradar.com/subscribe. So let's go. All right then, straight into the news. And we hear that Ubuntu is considering, well, Canonical is considering including Qt applications in the next Ubuntu, the one after 11.04, so 11.10.
The next, yeah. So that's this time next year?
No, that's 11.10.
It's October this year.
Right, okay.
The one.
What letter will Ubuntu be up to by then?
That'll be O, won't it? Because it's Natty Narwhal's 11.04, so...
That'll be what? The OK Ocelot.
OK Octopus.
That's not bad. Well,
quick, right to Mark.
Somebody put that forward. Oh, but
we've been there.
Mark Shawworth has posted on his blog that they're going to have to make room on the Ubuntu CD for the Qt libraries.
Why?
Well, he's saying the applications for Ubuntu should be chosen on their individual merit and not on some ideology or whether they have to abide by a particular toolkit. And to this end, what he wants to do is get Canonical working on making deconf bindings for Qt so that the Qt applications they do eventually include can write to the same configuration system. Wow. As the GNOME and GTK apps.
I'm so glad he said make room for Qt library on the CD, because when you emailed me that fateful day yesterday to say that Ubuntu was including Qt applications, I thought there's no way they're going to fit it all on the original 700 meg CD.
Well, I mean, they're going to have to make room for something, I guess.
Ubuntu is just going to become the brown SUSE.
I really don't understand why. I mean, if he'd listed an application or two that made it necessary, like if he said, I don't know, Qtractor was the application we have to include on the next release of Ubuntu, and to make that happen we need to squeeze on the Qt libs. That would make sense, but he hasn't said anything like that, has he? It's very vague. Is it because Unity might use Qt in 2D form, so they include them anyway?
Quite possibly, yeah. Yes, that he didn't mention that, or at least not in the bit that I read. But like you say, he didn't mention any specific applications. If he'd given three or four examples, yeah, of great applications that are better than the GNOME and Qt,
there's something ones, going on,
which there definitely are KDE, yeah, applications that are better than the
but it's not even KDE, is it? He wanted to make the distinction between KDE and Qt, and yes, he only said Qt, so it won't be Amarok, for example.
It won't be, no, and it won't be any KOffice components, no, or things like that. So
I think there's a hidden agenda to this announcement. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but it could be something like Unity. It could be that some kind of convergence with the Ubuntu desktop and some mobile platform, because Qt is obviously running on Nokia devices.
Yeah. I mean, it's more libraries, it's more stuff to keep in RAM as you're running your programs.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, I do Qt stuff, and I think it's a great API. Yeah, so I think it's good, but I don't know why he's doing it.
I guess we'll find out for 11.10, then. We'll see if they use any major Qt apps to take center stage. But like you say, so many of the best known ones are all KDE anyway. So
yeah,
well, KAlbum is obviously uses Qt, doesn't it?
True. Does that actually use any? Could you port it to Qt now that Qt is absorbing more KDE?
Let me cast my memory back. At the time, I mean, it's a KDE 3.5 application, so it uses things like the KDE toolbar, the menu, and the configuration system, which is interesting. I mean, we didn't actually talk about it, but a Qt app using deconf is going to be massively contentious to KDE people who, I mean, Aaron Sago 5-6 years ago hated the idea of deconf.
Yes.
And KDE developers have configured. Dconf is a global configuration file, really. It's a bit like the Windows registry. It's the successor to Gconf, and it goes in the it's the opposite to the way KDE stores configuration files, which is randomly or in a .kde directory, apps share whatever for each application. I actually quite like the idea of Dconf. I quite like the idea of having configuration files in one place.
Mm.
So that's probably a good thing.
But you think there'll be a backlash?
I think there will be a backlash.
There's always a backlash.
There's always a reason to argue, isn't there?
Only time will tell.
We'll return to this topic in 6 months, no doubt. Meanwhile, Google has announced that they're going to drop H.264 video decoding in the Chrome web browser. Now, they seem to have been pushing this for a while because they wanted to get people away from Flash. So they wanted it as a native video playback.
Yeah, Flash is still in there.
Well, yes, and then Flash is still in there. And now they're going in favour of WebM, which is their fully open video format that's supposedly unpatent encumbered and completely free. And
online opinion seems to think that it is still patent encumbered.
Well, anything that encodes and decodes video is probably going to tread on something, isn't
it? And any online opinion is going to be.
But the idea is that Google's saying, well, buying H.264 licences costs money, and while it isn't a big deal for them because they're uber rich, it's a bit of a problem for the next internet startup and the next Linux distributions and the like. They can't include it easily, so with WebM anyone can play back the video.
That sounds
quite disingenuous. Surely Google wants to tread on the next web startup and keep them down.
You'd think so, yeah. So there must be some other reasons for this, and it can't just be paying back money to...
It's got to be control, isn't it? I mean, they've got a useful kind of leverage in saying that you can't encode H.264 for free. I think decoding's free, it's not free as in patent free. So it's a useful device for them to say, look, you can use WebM freely to encode your stuff. It's almost as good as H.264, and you know it's closer to our philosophy. When really, I think they just want control.
But what kind of control can they get?
Well, they command the project, so they can steer it in the direction they want it to go. You know, no one's going to fork WebM and have the same kind of impact.
Yeah, that's true.
So they can make it run awesomely on their netbooks and not necessarily just as awesome code freely available.
Yeah, I mean, some people have criticised WebM for not being as good as H.264, but I don't think that's really that important. I mean, MP3 isn't as good as FLAC, for instance, but most of us are happy to use MP3s the majority of our music. And watching a YouTube video, don't need sparklingly high quality. You're not going to watch it on a 72-inch TV.
Actually, have you tried to watch cricket on YouTube?
No.
You can't see the ball. It's impossible.
Is that just because the fast bowling's so fast now?
Yeah, it's so fast that the ball is about 4 pixels wide. What? No. Yeah. So whatever you just said, it was wrong.
But part of the problem is there's hardware decoding facilities in a lot of devices for H.264 that takes the load off the CPU. So many of these, we're all using more and more mobile devices now, and they have these chips built in that can decode H.264 on their own.
Yeah, in fact, that's probably the biggest issue, isn't it? Just thinking about it. That's why iPhones and iPads are so successful with media streaming, because they've got the hardware decoding capabilities.
Well, and it keeps the battery life going as well, because that's not all taxing the CPU. Now, if everything starts having to decode WebM, and that's all done in algorithms running through the CPU.
Yeah.
Now, apparently WebM, and was it the V8 or VP8 codec behind it, there is kind of brewing hardware support for these devices. It might be coming for this codec, but it might be coming. But
I'm surprised that H.264 hardware decoding is so specific that it's tied to a certain codec. I mean, surely the algorithms are going to be different, but the same kind of DSP processing they're doing is going to be essentially the same. I'm surprised they can't an H.264 decoder can't be coerced to do WebM.
Yeah, you think it's a processor designed for specific things, moving blocks around, uncompressing things and the like. So,
but there's OpenCL, you know, using the same kind of hardware acceleration. Mm. I mean, if it can do 3D rendering and physics, then surely it can do another codec.
Yes, fingers crossed.
So maybe it's a driver thing.
Yeah, well, on the subject of drivers, the Firefox 4 is coming up, hopefully in the next few weeks. We don't really know just yet. And it's going to have hardware acceleration, but on the Linux side, this is going to be quite limited. They've had to set up a driver whitelist due to buggy drivers. So you can plonk Firefox 4 on your system, but you won't necessarily have accelerated graphic performance. You will if you've got a if you're using the proprietary NVIDIA driver.
Right.
But the other ones are apparently so buggy that they don't want to turn it on by default.
Hang on. So hardware acceleration, that's the same sort of thing that goes on in Compiz and will happen with GNOME 3 and it's glitzy graphics that takes the load off your CPU.
Doesn't
Firefox, like all applications, run on top of whatever graphics you've got? So how does that tap into hardware acceleration?
Well, I think it's for like rendering individual page elements and rendering the page together, and if it can do that through the GPU.
There's lots of 2D performance is usually, you know, bitmap matrix calculations, and if you can, for example, the hardware acceleration started off with making 3D games. So if a web page can be quickly pasted into a texture, which is then put on two polygons that are a square, and then you can send that to the graphics card and tell the graphics card to just handle that. So no matter how big the page is, it's just pretending it's a texture on a couple of polygons, and you scroll up and down it really quickly. That's in comparison to normal 2D matrix transformations, which can take an age. I mean, that's a very crude example, but that's essentially what they're doing. But to be able to do that, there needs to be the hardware drivers
to
do it.
To work with the GPUs.
Otherwise, it's just doing it in software.
But I mean, this is a bit of a bad. It's a bit of a shame. It's a bit of a bad advertisement.
It's not
Linux,
surprising, though, is it? Yeah. Does Chrome have any hardware acceleration? It feels like it because we've all said it's so quick.
It is so blazingly fast. But I'd imagine they'd have the same problems on Linux if certain video drivers are really buggy. But it's a bit frustrating because, you know, all the Windows users will be enjoying their.
Yeah, and also recently we've kind of been celebrating the fact that the Nuvo driver's got hardware accelerated, it's open source, and Intel have put a lot of money into their 3D graphics driver, and AMD.
Yeah, the ATI one.
The ATI drivers are now free and hardware accelerated and supposed to be performing well. So on paper, there's no difference to Windows, for example.
Yes.
Well, apart from DirectX.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not going to go down very well. But hopefully that will change in time. Hopefully the
maybe Wayland, something like Wayland. Maybe that's one a good argument for Wayland, because they can't predict the capabilities of the X Window system, but with Wayland they can.
Yeah.
Because that acceleration level is taken off the hardware and into the window environment.
Yes.
So they can at least be predictable. So I don't know. Maybe Wayland will solve the problem.
I haven't had any kind of proper graphics chip in years, though. I've always used Intel onboard graphics for as long as I can remember, since I had a Rage 128 card in an old PC.
Yeah. That's it. So. I've got an NVIDIA card. But, you know.
Do you use the proprietary driver with it?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Does it work all right?
Yeah, it does.
Well, you'll be able to experience accelerated Firefox then.
The dual screen stuff on the NVIDIA card's really good. It's better than Cinerella, whatever it's called.
Right. and there's one more thing as well in the news that just popped up.
One more thing!
Yay! Slightly different section of the show, but LibreOffice 3.3 was released just yesterday, wasn't it? Well, Tuesday, we
should say.
Yeah,
we're recording this on Wednesday.
Yeah, so Tuesday. And I downloaded it, the Linux version.
That was good.
And I couldn't work out what to do with it, because it turns out it had been double gzipped. It was a tar.gz file, but it should have been a tar.gz.gz file. Now, either that was some canny way for them to reduce the file size, which of course doesn't work, or it was just a mistake. And then I extracted this tarball, and the big, long, ridiculous directory name that appeared also had rc4 in it as well. Now, rc4 is apparently final, but they should have at least repackaged it.
Renamed it.
Yeah. If I can do that for macOS, I'm sure those guys can do it.
Sure Michael Meeks could have done that.
Exactly.
With a single command.
I went straight onto their IRC channel and typed in some messages about this and was completely ignored because I assumed they had to.
The rule of the party.
Another pint, Michael. What's this? I'm getting a message on Twitter. Oh, it's Mike Saunders. Bugger.
So I'll download it again today and check, and I'll download it every other day. I mean, it looks pretty much identical to OpenOffice.org 3.3, which is at least candidate 10 or something completely bonkers now.
Except for the about dialogue, which you showed us.
Yeah, if you go to help, and you go to the help menu and then credits, the screen turns completely grey for about 10 seconds with a flashing progress bar at the bottom, and then it loads up this gigantic spreadsheet with every contributor since like the Star Division days in 1995 in Germany. And but it's just a really, really bad presentation. Yeah. It looks horrendous. We all stood around my screen going, "What?
That's mad.
Why does it do this?"
We often stand around your screen going,
looking at whatever random piece of software I'm running. So, but good luck to them anyway, because it's clear that the OpenOffice community is getting harder and harder to work with. And
you know, I think Michael Meek said it with the release, that if you look at the rate of progress they've had in LibreOffice development over the last 3 months or 2 months, you know, in comparison to OpenOffice, it's lightning fast. You know, they've made lots of changes. There's the GoOO changes. There's all the Office 2007 XML changes in there. You know, it was quite a complex job building the two together, and it's also feature compatible with OOO 3.3.0. So, you know, they've done a lot in a short space of time, and it's only going to get better.
Presumably, it's a bit like the X386 to X.org fork, where finally the developers had the freedom to rush ahead and just. Yeah. I noticed that LibreOffice doesn't have a splash screen. It didn't when I started it up anyway, and it actually started up quite quickly.
Oh, I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. I can't just pull figures out of thin air. It seems to start up, but it might even be twice as fast as the normal OpenOffice installation I have, so that's pretty
good
cool
to know.
Yeah, finally becoming usable.
There'll be a review in the next issue anyway,
next issue of Linux Format.
Okay, it's time for my very favourite section, which is going to be even better with Effie here. It's Discovery of the Fortnite, which is brilliant. 2 weeks for American friends.
Yeah.
And Mexicans. Do Mexicans understand the concept of Fortnite?
I don't think so.
No. So there's not a convenient Spanish word for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Dos semanas.
2 weeks.
Oh, no. There is a word in Mexico. It's quincena, but it's normally 15 days.
Oh, right.
15 days?
That's close enough.
Yeah. Why such an arbitrary?
Salaries are normally paid in Mexico every 15 days rather than monthly.
Huh.
So
it's a quincena. So you can party twice a month then?
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
And that was my discovery.
Great.
Yeah, mine's rubbish, so I'm gonna leave it a little bit.
To mature, to develop and grow.
To make the impact as absolutely rubbish and as useless as possible.
All right, then I'll take over the helm. I've got three, but they're all quite small.
You're showing off.
Sorry. I found the GeoCities Izer, which is an excellent website in which you type in a URL and it converts that web page into an old late 90s GeoCities page with horrendous colours, scrolling banners, hundreds of little GIF animations everywhere, and apparently horrendous background music as well, which I haven't heard because I don't have any sound here in the office, but MIDI
That's
files
brilliant.
And things.
You've just given me a brilliant idea for a new one as well, for MySpace Arizer. So multiple tracks playing at once.
Yeah, and 500
awful
videos.
Photos and millions of comments saying, "Thanks for friending me."
There we go. Part two is a distro I came across called Fuduntu. Now, please, anybody who spends a lot of time looking at computer forums and general computer forums knows that the hundreds and hundreds of Linux distributions all trying to do the same thing, be a good desktop OS, is a source of confusion for new users. It is a problem, despite the denials in the Linux community.
Are you dissing change?
Change and freedom and cereal, freedom to choose your cereal. No, it is a problem for people when they say, "Which distro should I try?" I see this all over the internet, and when somebody comes out with Fuduntu, it only adds to the whole entropy and the mess and the confusion.
Fud, F-U-D.
F-U-D. Fuduntu, yeah, it's a Fedora remixed, optimized for netbooks. Now, I'm sure there's already hundreds of distros optimized for netbooks, so A, don't make one, contribute to another one and make it better, and B, if you do make one, don't call it that. Don't just make things even more complicated.
Mike, but is it because it seems to me that developers are running out of words.
Probably are.
For distros.
Exactly, yeah, I mean, you know.
The vocabulary shrinking, yeah. Actually, for titles for distros.
They're going to have to use, like, random letters and sequences of, like, MD5 sums and things to name distros soon, so...
I guess the F is for Fedora, then, because I thought it was about fear, uncertainty and doubt.
Well, even you were confused.
Yeah.
I thought it was food unto. So it's food applications about, you know, cooking.
And K-recipes and things like that. There we go. If we geeks are confused by it, then think of new users. Stop naming
think
things
of the
like
children.
That. Somebody think of the children, please.
Thank you, Daddy.
But I've got a good one to end with. And this was on the 10th of January. I went to the PC Linux OS website, and I was absolutely enthralled that their slogan at that time was, PC Linux OS, it's like bacon, but better.
After a hangover? Hangover.
See, that's talent, actually, isn't it, really? There's not very much talent in the distro marketing department. Yeah.
There we go. That's the way to do it.
That's good work.
So, over to you back in the studio, Andrew.
Thanks, Mike. I've got 1.5 discoveries.
Cool.
While trying fruitlessly to get GNOME Shell to work on my machine of unknown provenance.
A mongrel of a machine.
Who knows what bits of bobs are in that box? I installed Mandriva on VirtualBox and tried to get it running on that, and it failed. But it reminded me of how awesome Mandriva is.
Wow!
It hasn't gone away. No, we talk about, you know, Gael de Val and Ultimo and how, you know, the Mandriva has been in bankruptcy protection a couple of times.
Yeah.
All sorts of other financial and business related stories. But the distro has not gone away. The community is still there. The developers are still working on it. And it's still really, really good.
I mean, I guess a lot of the developers community have gone over to the Magaia fork project.
Majua,
yeah, the one that started in December, and it seems to have gone a bit quiet recently. Maybe. But so what, you got the latest release and grabbed the latest packages, updates and things?
Yeah,
and
yeah, and it's the installation process, really, because I'm not going to run it full time. I just wanted to see if a specific piece of software ran on it.
Yeah. Mm.
But the installation process was so simple, so dead easy. You know, I'd also installed Mint and Fedora in the same week, and it just shone out at me how, you know, how nice and simple and easy to use it is, and how they're not trying to do anything massively complicated. If you've used a couple of Linux distros, then you will be comfortable with Mandriva. It just seems so forgotten about.
Well, I mean, they pioneered the graphical installer, really. Yeah. I don't know if they were the first, but back in, I think it was Mandrake 6 or 7, they were one of the first major distributions to have a full start-to-finish graphical installer.
It was my first, I think we've mentioned it before, but it was certainly my first proper Linux installation.
Yeah.
Right.
They did release, actually, Mandriva released a new version of their distribution in the new year. I think it was 2010.1, but refashioned for education. For education establishments in France, presumably. So maybe that's where they're putting their focus on. Because in France, I think lots of schools and places have to use free software.
Yes.
That sounds like we should get the boss to send us all on a big school trip to
south of France.
To Languedoc, Roussillon. To check out their education department.
What do you say, new boss?
Sacre bleu.
Oui.
Great. That, you heard it first.
Oui, d'accord.
Let's go. Please write to Graham if we don't get this trip to France.
J'aime bien l'informatique.
Avec le champignon.
Et le vin. Du pain.
Du bois.
So the 0.5 of a discovery was that during the installation, the Mandriva installation process, it asks you what language you want to use. And it gives you a list of English, American English, Canadian English, New Zealand English, Irish English, and Australian English.
Wow. Bonza.
I had no idea. First of all, mad props to our French cousins and ancestral enemies for not calling it UK English. It's English. It's from England. Thanks for that. And And also, how different is Irish English to English English anyway?
I don't know. Have you got any Irish heritage in you?
Jesus, no.
If only we knew someone who used to live in Ireland.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool, wouldn't it? Effie?
you must have seen plenty of the world on cruise ships.
That's true.
Yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
So anyway,
it's really political.
As a gesture of solidarity to our colonial cousins in Australia, and today being Australia Day.
Is it?
Thursday or the Wednesday?
Recording day.
Wednesday, the 26th of October, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Cool.
Brumaire. It's Australia Day today, so I've installed it in Australian.
I'm interested to see in that list you read out there wasn't Botswanan English, because I came across that when I was installing a distro the other day. I'm sure Botswanan English is full of great words to do with safari parks and things like that.
English, it's the lingua franca. That's why we don't need different versions of it.
I guess...
go on then.
I'll mention my rubbish one. But because it isn't really one. I took Friday off last week to build a project.
This is geekily excellent.
Cool. Because I've already bought Mike and Andrew and probably Effie with the thing. I built a synthesizer called a MIDI Box SID. It's a kit that you can buy from a community called the MIDI Box community. It's all free. It's all open source, so the PCB, the schematics and all that stuff, you can get your hands on that, and the complicated firmware that runs on the PIC chip as well, it's all open source. And what you do is you put it all together, you deconstruct a Commodore 64 from the mid 80s and take out the sound chip and stick the sound chip onto the PCB and plug it all together, plug it into a MIDI port, and you get SID sounds coming out of a box, which is awesome, and it sounds incredible. But my discovery is that the MIDI box community, coming from the open source community, is a funny thing. I mean, I don't really want to criticize it, mainly because they get very angry. It's like kicking a hornet's nest. Mm-hmm. But they're when telling Andrew and Mike about it, they're very much of the RTFM kind of mindset, that if you ask any kind of question that's in any kind of documentation, they'll point you to it. Some guy asked what the knobs on one of the boxes did, and he was pointed to the assembler source code.
Assembler?
To find out for himself what exactly those knobs did. And people have asked, oh, I've got this box, how do I get it to work with it? And people have said, well, it can be done because I've done it with mine. And there's no further comment. And also, you need explicit permission from the community elders to resell your box. What? Even though you've bought it, you've built it, you put it together yourself, because this is the way that it works. It's a relatively small niche community, and everybody kind of accepts it, because the people in the community don't want it to be commercialized.
Outside,
they don't have any right to say it. Now, it's easy. I don't think that's right. It's easy to criticize it, but the end result is the quality of the PCBs and the box itself, the firmware, is absolutely incredible. It's faultless. The documentation that goes with the firmware is incredible, and so is the support. And it's a worthy question as whether this kind of control results in better quality.
Well, it is an interesting argument, yeah, because we talk about fragmentation, splintering in the Linux world, and if tighter control, if a more top-down approach would lead to a more cohesive desktop experience.
That sounds like next week's open ballot. Well,
and that's my discovery. That's really made me think about it, because I really don't like the attitude. I'm really all for, if I've done something and it works from the box, here, this is how I did it. You know, don't struggle through the assembler source code. This is what the words are. But
so, you know, just about this, you got two SID chips from old Commodore 64s, didn't you?
I suppose I could put in a plea. I had three Commodore 64s from the 80s. One was the best Christmas present I ever had. My mum and dad, who couldn't really afford it, surprised me in 1985 with a Commodore 64. And I've still got that Commodore 64.
Wow.
And the SID chip from that Commodore 64 from that ultimate Christmas in 1985 is now sitting in a MIDI box and once again making sounds and making me happy.
I mean, that must be the longest use of a piece of technology that you can get. We all buy our gadgets and then throw them away in 5 years or...
But I'm looking for more, because the other two computers, the SID chips in them are broken.
Right.
And the MIDI box takes two. So, right. I could do another one, otherwise it's eBay. Every SID chip sounds different as well, but this is a geeky audio conversation.
Yeah, but you've tempted me to try and to hear some SID music, because I was a ZX Spectrum user and I was used to the kind of crunching, bleeping little sound
waves. Well, I'll bring it in. It's only a small box. Maybe I'll bring it in for the next podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's genuine analog sound. It's cool. Really, really, it's a beautiful sound. It's just great.
There we go. Tune in 2 weeks.
So, I don't know. Do you want to say anything?
Yeah, well, my discovery, no, it's not a discovery, I'm just really glad about one thing, checking the TuxRadar website. I didn't realize how widespread the Linux communities in the Latin American countries, living in England for so long, I never really realized how this is spreading all over Latin America, especially when, unfortunately, most of those countries use pirate copies of commercial applications and operating systems in the computers. I think it's actually a really good thing that the world of Linux is spreading through the continent, the Latin American continent. I noticed that because there's a lot of comments of Latin American and Spanish spoken people in the section of the GIMP PDF tutorials.
Yeah, the page on TuxRadar with all those GIMP tutorial PDFs we put up ages ago. Yeah, and we keep seeing loads and loads of Spanish comments on there, don't we? People saying thank you for these tutorials. So
I think it's a nice thing to find within the community. So keep going, guys, in Latin America. If you want to carry on sending comments in Spanish, please do so. I reply to them. That's it.
That's cool.
Wow, multilingual TuxRadar.
Is Javier from Mexico?
Javier Hernandez, he plays for Manchester United.
Yeah. Do you know him?
Yeah, he's my cousin. He's my nephew.
When you speak to your family back in Mexico and tell them you work for a magazine that writes about Linux, has any of them ever heard of it?
No. No. Even the most up-to-date techie members of the family don't know. And that's what I mean. It's a shame that the Linux community doesn't actually spread the word themselves. They don't take it on board and go out and I don't know, illustrate people in Latin America about the beauty about Linux. Mm. Of Linux. It's down to the people to find out about it. And I think that is a shame.
It's word of mouth, isn't it?
Well, it's also down to Linux users to evangelize and convert people to Linux. Which we'll be talking about in just a few short minutes.
So, with such Latin fun, we come to the halfway point of our podcast. Coming up, we've got You Dare Us, our tablet designs. We've got In the Dock, and it's my turn to convince people about something. And, of course, the results of our open ballot. Stay tuned.
Right, it's time for You Dare Us. Last week, you dared us to design our own tablet computers, and to stop them from spiralling way off into the realms of mental fantasy, we had to come up with a realistic price point for them.
Oh, did we?
Yes, you know we did.
£50.
In a Kinder Egg.
£50. I might as well go first.
Yeah.
Because my ideas are...
Have you already drawn it? I'm going to put my glasses on.
No, but if you just...
We have to design a tablet.
There it is.
Aha.
That's incredible.
It's very minimalist. No. It's very Mondrian.
Well, but minimalism is kind of what I want. It's just got the Gwibber logo on the desktop and the Firefox logo.
Okay.
I've just got into this here Twitter lark.
Twitterer?
Yeah.
Mm.
I'm being followed by Diane Abbott and the Conservatives.
Great. The entire Conservative Party.
I'm being followed by the Royal Festival Hall on that link. It sits there, the air conditioning wobbling.
Not just Diane Abbott and the Conservative Party, obviously. There are many other people.
Other parties do exist.
Many other, lots of really eligible young Nigerian girls.
Cool.
So back to this tablet. Taking the iPhone and iPad as an inspiration, they're both about £400. So the iPad is more like, it's just a big version of the phone that does less stuff. So if you take that with a HTC Desire,
that's 250 quid. So I thought you could.
Andrew is working this out on a piece of paper.
So carry the one there.
So I thought,
make things
bigger. Take away the phone functionality and add all the stuff that people have known about from the iPad, like a forward-facing camera, USB. It doesn't need to do all that much because people don't do all that much on them.
So you're saying it'd be an Android machine then?
It will definitely be an Android machine.
Right.
I don't want to mess about with Palm or
Gentoo,
iOS or or Slackware or KDE 4
MicOS.
Any of that. I don't even want Unity.
Right.
I just want applications that open in full screen, one at a time. Fair enough, they can run in the background, maybe in a little panel down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. That should be small.
Okay. So, and you're saying around 250 quid mark for this?
I think that's realistic, because that's what a comparable Linux-based smartphone costs.
Okay. And what are you going to call this tablet? Because that's by far the most important thing.
Oh, I didn't think of that.
I haven't thought of the name either.
Oh, you got the thing. It's got a pad or slate or Touchmaster 824.
Touchmaster. Yeah.
Well, tell you what.
It's going to be called the Tin Eye.
Tin Eye?
Tinny.
Which stands for This Tin Eye Is Not an iPad.
Oh, brilliant. Kudos to you.
That's genius.
I just want to buy one alone, just for the recursive acronym nonsense. Well, mine's the MicPad 3000, of course.
That's going to be really dated in like 989 years.
Yeah, but you've got to give people a reason to upgrade, you know. I want to keep selling new products all the time. I'm not a charity, so... I mean, I'm thinking... 8-inch screen, 1 gigahertz ARM chip, 256 megs of RAM. I don't think people need that much RAM on these devices, because the people aren't...
More than the iPad.
Sorry?
More than the iPad.
Well, the iPad's 256, isn't it? And I think...
But if you make it 257...
Yeah.
Then you can say that you're one faster.
Well, that's true. I'll include, some extra register on the CPU.
Memory's a weakness on the iPad.
You think so?
Yeah.
I guess it depends how much people use... I'm thinking, for light browsing and a bit of music, then.
Yeah, but page caching...
Yes.
PDFs.
But I mean, 256 megs, you should still be able to cache a lot of web pages in that.
I know. I spent £100 on a 512K expansion for my Amiga and...
Memories.
Oh. Unbelievable.
We'll cover that in depth in another podcast, no doubt. But I'm going to have just an 8GB SSD in mine as well, because I'm focusing this on internet usage, so you don't need a massive amount of local storage. And this will help to keep the prices down. I'm thinking of £299, but I've got two special features on mine. On the bezel, it's going to have a D-pad and buttons for gaming, because we all like to try and play some retro games on tablet devices and handhelds, and we always miss D-pads because you need some physical tactile buttons. So I have these on the side. And the other thing is, a guarantee, as much as it's technically possible, that you will always have the latest Android.
Yeah.
Because one of the things we know annoys people monumentally is that they buy a device, it comes with Android 2.1, then Android 2.2 comes out with a bucket load of new features, and they can't get them, and they wait for the manufacturer to make an update, or they have to go and download some hacked ROM themselves, and it all gets really, really messy. So at least for the users like us, the ability to keep getting the latest Android, or at least the next three major releases or something like that,
would be
good. You know, you're not going to be left behind. So there we go, the MicPad 3000 coming to you soon for £299. Oh, VAT's gone up, hasn't it? So it'll be 307 quid or something. Nice one. Ah, Graham?
Well, I think the most important thing is that it looks good. So I've concentrated on the design of mine.
Okay.
There it is. I've got it drawn on a piece of paper.
Wow, that's pretty shiny. It's got no buttons.
It is shiny. It's got one button. Oh. It looks very much like an iPad. I like simplicity. It's actually got, but in different to an iPad, it's actually got an aluminium bevel, which is shaped just like the kind of arc on your thumb, just so you can move your thumb along it. Mm. And here in the bottom right corner is the button.
That is a button.
One button.
Right.
I want to touch it.
Yeah. You just touch it on the side, and it's glossy. It's thin. It's got a single port, which is a mini USB port. I think that's all I'm interested in.
Headphones or anything?
Oh, yeah, headphones
too. Okay.
Power from the mini USB. And I guess, just thinking about it, a memory card reader would be pretty handy. I'll stick that on there too.
Parallel port.
yeah.
Why not?
And well, maybe there's a USB expansion for that.
Okay.
And that's it, really. I think it's got to look gorgeous. It's got to, people have got to want to pick it up and hold it and play with it. And I think that's the most important thing. So I guess looking at the design, it's going to be expensive. So I'm going to say it's the same price as the iPad, but it'll definitely have more memory. It'll be running Android. It'll have a faster CPU, just because we can. And it'll be open, which is the second most important thing after the aesthetics.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
An ARM CPU or an Atom or...
Well, I don't think we could get an Atom in there, so...
No, not without some ARM. All the fans and ARM's stuff.
ARM's good enough for Apple, it'd be good enough for me.
Okay.
I'll put a scan of that.
And the name of this device?
The GNU.
The GNU.
Oh, I don't want to buy it anymore.
So, Effie, you've been drawing something while we've been talking about this. Have you come up with an idea for a tablet?
Well, yeah, I drew the Flintstones version, which is a hammer and a chisel against a piece of wood. That's a tablet. For this tablet. Then I moved on a few years, and I want a tablet that you can, rather than being solid, rectangular shape, it would be bendy. So you can roll it and put it in a cylinder and put it in your rucksack or something like that.
Well,
more about futuristic ideas, right?
Right.
Than here and now.
I think it'll happen. Yeah.
There are screens. Yeah. They are developing screens that you can roll up and stuff like that. I guess the problem would be the battery. You need a very flexible battery that didn't pop.
There could be sort of power, kind of. Or
powered by love. Oh.
By love. By love.
We're talking about the future here, guys.
There you go.
Great. I can see that working.
Yeah.
Effie wins. Archie, you haven't given a price, Effie, and that was one of the requirements for this challenge.
A price.
How much is it going to cost this?
Oh, sorry. But because I'm thinking about future, it probably is going to cost about £1 million.
A million euros.
A million euros. We're going to join the euro. Sorry. We might go back to original currency, and it would cost something like 3,000.
Three camels. Okay, 3,000 camels for Effie's bendable tablet thing. You choose what you want.
In the future.
Good one. I like that.
Oh, and before we all die of hysterics, we need to think of another challenge for the next 2 weeks. Now, I've thought of one. How about we all try and contribute something to an open source project?
It's a brilliant idea.
That's an excellent idea.
But
the commitment scares me.
Well, you only have to do it once.
Well, hang on, no, because we can if we do this, then that'll be quite worth. We'll be able to turn it into some pages for the magazine, hopefully.
As well.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good idea.
Okay. Sounds good.
So that means that there's an incentive to do it well. I'm sure we can, I don't know, try it.
So it doesn't have to be, I guess you're saying any kind of contribution, so documentation, code.
Bug fix, images,
logo,
you know,
design.
Music, logo design.
Spanish
anything.
Translation.
Yeah. Absolutely. But
you're here now, you actually have to do it.
Yeah.
Right, do that.
So, any kind of contribution, anything where you can sit down and go, yeah, I've made a difference to an open source project.
Okay,
now, I mean, you know, we make, Graham and I make open source software anyway and release it on the internet, so we've done our own contributions, but so we can't call those.
You can't contribute to macOS, for example.
No, exactly.
So we've got to contribute to a project that's already going.
Find some
update.
Take note, people who want to help. Contribute to something that's already going.
Yeah, don't just make a new one called Fuduntu.
Right, it's now time for our almost shiny new section, which we've called In the Dock. It's the second time we've tried this. It seems all right.
Oh, let's have more enthusiasm. It's an absolutely brilliant section.
It is. Okay, it's an incredible section.
It was awesome last week.
Yes, last week Graham had...
A few people tried KDE.
Yeah, Graham had 1 minute, exactly 1 minute, to explain to people why they should use KDE. 1 minute to try and convert all those GNOME and XFCE heathens to actually be using his favourite desktop. And according to the comments we got from you listeners, a few of you have tried it.
Went back to GNOME.
Yeah, so...
So, yeah.
Okay, so it's my turn.
So, yep, it's Mike's turn this episode. So Mike's got a minute to try and convince us to use XFCE, I believe.
To forget everything that Graham told you last week and use my desktop of
choice.
Which
is nice, there's a bit of balance in that. So if you found KDE wasn't to your liking, maybe XFCE is the answer. So I'll count down 3, 2, 1, and then we'll go.
Okay, so deep breath.
Ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
Now, if you use a lot of GTK apps, then chances are you'll want to run the GNOME desktop environment. But as we know, GNOME is big and memory heavy, and it has problems. It has problems with usability. The GNOME developers think they always know best. They have this kind of opinion that they want to make the desktop and you're just kind of fit around it. They've been removing options. They've been tweaking things. And I remember a conversation on a mailing list back in 2005 where Havoc Pennington, the Metacity author, didn't want to introduce a wireframe mode because he said, and I quote, "I don't see a speed problem on my system." Well, I want that choice. I want that. XFCE is faster than GNOME. It gives me loads more configurability. It gets out of my way. And I run a lot of GTK apps, so they all fit perfectly well together. So I like the fact it doesn't try and expand its libraries into every program. It's happy to just work with normal GT programs like AbbeyWord and GNUmeric, and it doesn't try and XFCE-arize all of them. So as we come to the final few seconds of this, I'll say, please use XFCE.
A good one. Well done. That was exactly on time. Pretty convincing argument, I think.
Do you reckon?
Yeah. I didn't use XFCE recently, but I did use some incredibly lightweight window manager.
I can't remember what it was actually. LXDE maybe.
It was the one that I played with Puppy Linux for a few days. So.
Right, yes.
Something. But anyway, it was just so refreshing to have things appear immediately and for there to be no cruft and no worry about what might be running in the background. And it was... I genuinely thought about switching to it just for a brief moment.
I mean, I'm not anti-GNOME. I would use GNOME, but I find that the whole caboodle together, when you've got Evolution Data Server running and things like that, I'm I just like to look at my process list and know everything that's on there, and I don't want to see lots and lots of cruft and gunk running.
I completely see it. I can see why it's a good choice.
Mm. So that means in the next podcast, it'll be Andrew's turn, so you've got 2 weeks to think of an argument that you want to put forward.
Genome.
Sequencing the human genome. Why it's a good or bad thing. Yeah, controversial. Okay.
Right, thanks for that, Mike. It's now time for Open Ballots.
Yay.
Which, this fortnight, we asked the question, have you converted anyone to Linux?
Wow.
It's a good question.
It's an excellent question.
We got a lot of feedback as well, didn't we?
And we've had some excellent answers.
Excellent.
Which we'll get to in a bit. Actually, no. We've had some excellent answers, and 50. Can anyone? Oh, I've almost given it away there.
57.
Can anyone guess?
59.
Out of the 59 people who replied.
Yeah.
Can anyone guess how many of those have converted someone to Linux and how many haven't?
It looked about 40 to 20 from what I when I had a scan of the responses. 40 had and about 20 or so hadn't. Mm-hmm. So.
I think it was closer. Most people who replied had done so because they'd had a successful attempt. So I'd say over 50. I'd say 52 people had.
Right.
I'd say 57.
So only two people hadn't.
Well, Graham is right. Coincidentally, I've written it here on this piece of paper which he can see quite clearly.
Well,
and it was 52-7, so maybe that's why Effie guessed 57.
I didn't see it.
Not that you're rank cheats or anything.
I promise I didn't see it.
All right. Well,
I did scan through the comments. I knew most of them.
I think that's a pretty stunning success rate, actually. No, if assuming that most people are at least trying or making some sort of effort, no matter however small, for approximately 91% of those attempts to be successful is pretty damn good.
But it also shows that if everyone who was using Linux now converted someone in the next 12 months, the Linux user community would be twice the size.
Yeah.
Which is kind of easy, I think.
It's like vampires.
Yeah,
it is like vampires.
Absolutely. Viruses. Vampires.
But the difference is that when you kill the head vampire... the Linux users stay. They remain.
Right.
And that's awesome. So, how how have we fared in our last, in our years of using Linux?
Well, I guess in the 10 years that I've been writing about Linux, I hope that I've been able to convert thousands and thousands of people to using Linux, at least giving it a try. And then they've converted people as well, so...
So yeah. Indirectly, you're responsible for all the great things happening ever.
In the world in general, well, yeah.
That's pretty lame, Mike.
Oh, but what...
An example from my own experience, nobody actually, or well, few people set out to actually want to install Linux. Not many people will say, yes, I want that one, when they've got something that works perfectly well already. In my case, my old flatmate, Zoe, didn't want to use her Mac, which was upstairs, up one flight of stairs. She preferred to use my Linux machine because it was in the same room.
Right.
That's not a question about things not working or viruses or blue screens of death. That's sheer and utter laziness of not being bothered to go upstairs.
Shame on her.
To collect her own machine.
But at the same time, it means that she could get on with it without actually the effort required in learning to use Linux was less than the effort of going upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely minimal mental effort, just, you know, how do I get to this, how do I get to that? Oh, it's, you go up here and click on that, and yeah, then there's the menu, there's Firefox, away you go.
So we've got an advertising campaign here then. Linux, it's easier than stairs.
Well, it is really easy. If someone's, and one of the things that comes out in all the responses, and thanks everyone for getting in touch, is that it's all about, well, it's a lot easier when someone else does the installation. It's a lot easier when someone else does the installation. Most people have had success when they've taken someone's PC or laptop and then and installed Mint or Ubuntu or Fedora or whatever.
Right.
And then taken about half an hour to show people how to install software, where the most commonly used programs are, and then given it back to the person, and then they're fine.
Right. Did you get a feeling, in reading through the comments, did you find any particular distro that stood out that people were recommending or that more people had used to convert?
It's as you would expect. It's the usual suspects. It's Ubuntu and Mint.
Right.
Fedora gets an honourable mention. Slackware, Gentoo, unsurprisingly not mentioned. Started off with OpenSUSE, Ubuntu, Linux Mint 9, PC Linux OS...
I'd imagine Mint is a very, very good choice because it's got all the Ubuntu stuff inside, so people can get help from Ubuntu forums, but it comes with all the codecs and the like pre-packaged in. It looks nice, so you've got all those three things together.
Does it look nice?
It's kind of shiny. Yeah.
It feels too much like Windows to me. You know, everything's in that start menu.
Yeah.
And then it comes up with your favourites, which aren't actually my favourites.
Your most hated applications.
Leave me alone. Just let me choose.
I've not had any real success converting people. I must have to be completely honest. Other than wanting to get involved and wanting to make a contribution when I first started with Linux. But in terms of people I come into contact with, my family, my mum, other members of the family, I've tried to get them to use Linux, and my mum's Dell laptop, which is running Windows XP, is a hideous pile of rubbish. It's awful. It barely works, and I can't convince her to just for me to just spend half an hour sticking Ubuntu on it or something. I try and tell her that it won't make any difference. She won't notice anything that's missing. In fact, it'll be so much better. She'll be able to use her computer again. But
What sort of programs does she use?
Well, she chooses Instant Messenger, and she uses Firefox, at least, and she uses OpenOffice occasionally. So she uses free software.
I mean, fine with it, yeah.
It's actually easier to convince people to use free software. I've made lots of people use Firefox and OpenOffice.
Yes, I have converted a lot of people to Firefox, yeah.
Because you can just stick it on the desktop, and they've also got a choice between spending £150 on MS Office or not.
Yeah, and most people have heard that Internet Explorer is dodgy because it's been on like BBC News and the likes, so that IE is bad. So
she's using free software, but I can't convince her to switch to Linux. She's almost 70, and she just she's just not scared of it because she doesn't know what she's scared of, but Windows is just too comfortable for her. And I've had this a few years ago. I got on my niece a netbook which was running Linux, and she used Linux on it for a while, but in the end she was using it for school, and the school needed her to have better flash support, and she had to install Windows to get better flash support on it because flash performance was dreadful on the netbook.
Really?
And there's been a few people like that over the years where I've tried and failed.
That's pretty much the opposite of what Kevin Collier said. He reckons that there is more resistance to moving from MS Word to OpenOffice than to Linux in general. People find ODT versus doc more confusing than slash home versus C.
Well, I set up doc to be the default file format in OpenOffice. And I also do the same for Firefox, so that really, I mean, my mum doesn't know that it's Firefox and doesn't know that it's OpenOffice necessarily. She's not that stupid, but you know what I mean.
Why would she have to care, though?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the internet.
Yeah. I think it is easy to just put OpenOffice on a Windows desktop, and they have a choice then. It's like a no-through road reinstalling Linux for some people.
Lots of mums actually being converted to Linux usage. Either Popey or Popeye says, my mum asked me for a computer, she'll be 70 next year and has never used one before. So there's probably no Microsoft inertia there. I bought an Acer Revo desktop from eBay and installed Ubuntu on it. She now does email, Facebook, YouTube, and manages her photos with Picasa.
Yeah.
I remotely support her via encrypted SSH and VNC. I rarely get support calls from her. Full stop. It just works. Full stop.
Right, well, I'm going to do it. I think Popey's story is... I cannot tolerate my mum having any more problems with Windows. I'm going to do it, and I'll let you know how it goes on. I live actually about 150 miles away from my mum, but next time I see her, I'll steal a laptop and stick Linux on there.
More conversion success stories. Eric Messer says, I've converted my wife to Linux, installed Ubuntu on her computer. She's okay with Linux 90% of the time, but the 10% of the time when she isn't, she hates it. She hates that OOO is not exactly the same as MS Office. She knows all kinds of crazy tricks in Excel and is annoyed that she can't do it in OpenOffice. Well, that's sort of mixed success, I suppose. Mr. Pete M. says, my wife's Vista laptop always had wireless printing and network issues, and then it finally blue screened. So Vista was kicked off and Mint installed, and everything works great. He also goes on to say, my next door neighbour, the policeman, had an old Toshiba laptop with Windows XP that was black screening. Weirdly, Ubuntu and Mint wouldn't get past the disk partitioner during install, so I went with Fedora. He's happy, and I quote, it just works, and it's saving £30 a year in antivirus.
Yeah.
So that's, not to try and go all Andy Gray and Richard Keys, but that's a woman, an old person, and a policeman who've all managed to use Linux.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, Ron Labor says, my wife, she does not even know it's Linux. And like we said, you don't have to know. She uses Firefox on Linux and had previously been using Firefox on Windows. All she does is Firefox and Gmail and never misses a beat.
These are really good stories, aren't they?
There's loads, so many.
It's really positive. It feels great.
There's a lot of love in the room. Tony Hughes from Blackpool Lug has... tells us about the people that he's helped convert to Linux, and then goes on to say, the best thing about helping others use Linux is that as I'm solving their problems, I'm gaining more knowledge of how Linux works for myself.
Good. That's
it's kick-ass.
I think it's great to hear all these Linux success stories, and it also tells us a lot. Like, we kind of know that so many people just use web browsers and the like, and going and spending money on Windows and then all the necessary stuff you have to have with it as well, it's a ridiculous waste of money. If all you need is a web browser, and just get Linux if that's all you use.
I think it'd make a great kind of marketing campaign with the idea of, you know, converting one person to Linux over the next 12 months. You know, all these kind of testaments to people doing the same thing in like a big advertisement with their faces. You know, these are the people who we converted to Linux. It'd be great.
Here's the website. Here's the converter of the week.
Yeah.
Or just a random.
Or just positivity. You know, lots of people's faces smiling, saying yeah. I use Linux, it's great.
The Linux Foundation could sponsor it at extremely minimal cost of, you know, a t-shirt a week or something.
Yeah.
It'll cost nothing.
Or special rates on their credit card.
Yeah. Only, you know, 15.1% APR. Anonymous Penguin.
Thanks for getting in touch, Anonymous Penguin.
We're not supposed to read these out.
Well, no, but this just goes to show what Anonymous Penguin is doing wrong, so we can
diss him.
Diss him or her. Last few years, I've given family members the latest Ubuntu disk. Can we see what he's done wrong there already?
Uh-oh.
Even gave them a simple book on how to use Linux.
Was it the Haynes Linux manual by Mike Saunders?
Well, I doubt it. And if you let me read on, I think you'll see why. It's so easy, it works, doesn't crash, free, no viruses, does what you need, but no, I'm still supporting Windows on their machines. They complain, cuss, and call me, while I happily use Ubuntu with no problems. Do they listen? No. Sigh.
I bet he's lovely to live with.
I dual boot my machine to Windows 7, but only boot over to Windows less than 5% of the time.
She actually calculated that up. Oh no, it's 5.1%.
Anonymous Penguin, whatever book you gave them on how to use Linux was probably the wrong book. You want the Haynes Manual for Linux.
Yeah. Wait.
Is that what it's called?
The Haynes Linux Manual.
The Haynes Linux Manual.
ISBN.
Available on all good Amazons near you, and also bookshops. But you'll probably find that if you're spending that much time supporting their problems with Windows, you know, if you add that up to a number of hours per week or hours per month or something, if you just divide that by 10 and spend that amount of time explaining how Linux works with them in the first instance,
yes,
install it yourself.
That is it. Just throwing a disk at somebody is never going to work because they probably don't. They might not even have to boot from the disk anyway.
It's the equivalent of RTFM.
It is, yeah.
I converted my father-in-law to use Linux about a year ago, and the reason why he decided to stick Linux on his Toshiba laptop was because he saw me using Ubuntu back then.
Right.
I think I was surfing the net and I was sending some video through some video, and he saw me doing it, and he decided to ditch Windows XP that it was crashing all the time, and then I installed Ubuntu on his computer. But it was because he saw me using it.
So
he realized that the usability was fairly simple.
So it's like leading by example there.
Yeah,
then
it was more than curiosity. He thought it actually looks quite easy to use, and that's what it triggered his desire to install Linux on his computer.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe that's a way to reassure people, is to, instead of telling them and saying, let's put Linux on your machine, show them it working on your machine for a few hours first, and all the different things that you're doing to reassure them that they can still go on Facebook and they can still watch YouTube videos and the other things, and write documents and letters and stuff that people need to do.
Yeah. It's easy to show something that exists, but you can't show them the absence of viruses.
True.
Or the absence of the financial cost.
You can make them imagine it. You can get them to save up money and put it in a pot.
Exactly. Well, this... Yes, Mr. Pete M said that the policeman is saving £30 a year in antivirus subscription costs.
Well, there we go.
Which is great. You can probably hold up, like, 3 pints and say, look, imagine how much you've saved.
Yeah.
A brilliant, brilliant comment from Merely Jim, who says in his apartment, in his apartment complex, he's installed Linux Mint 10 on 5 machines since Christmas, and another 5 in the preceding months. My neighbours know me as the guy that makes their machines usable again when they get a virus on Windows.
Cool.
I spend 20 minutes installing a dual boot version, putting OpenOffice and stuff on the Windows side, and then showing them how to use a computer for half an hour. That's how long it takes. They usually pay me back with invitations to cookouts and beer.
Oh, that's the best form of remuneration on the planet.
Absolute win. Nice work, Merely Jim. Phelan Whiteley says some words, and also, now if only Graham would fix the RSS feed so Amarok works again.
Yeah.
Season 2, episode 24 is the last it picks up.
I know, and did look a few down from that. Oh,
that's just a lame excuse.
Okay.
You've just said it doesn't work with mine, or it works okay with mine. You've done the same as that Metacity fella.
Yeah,
well,
havoc.
The thing is, it's almost impossible to know what the problem is because I can't recreate the problem.
Why don't I use Twitter? I can ask him on Twitter.
Yeah. Has he replied? I haven't checked today.
I know, but Phelan's following me, my silence on Twitter.
Oh, well, that's good. You could ask him, because obviously we'd really like to get it sorted out, whether it's a version number problem, because I haven't got the very latest version of Amarok.
And if that doesn't work, you can ask the entire Conservative Party to sort it out for
you. Yeah. Or Diane Abbott.
One final shout-out to hydrophones.com. Who says, although the Australian government keeps pushing Microsoft, the young people here, presumably Australia, seem to prefer Linux. I've taught many of the local teenagers how to install Linux and make clusters of older used Linux machines. They have a regular game and multimedia grid going.
Pretty cool.
That sounds good, but I really only read it out to get another shout-out for our Australian cousins.
Yeah,
Bonza.
Fantastic. I really like all those stories. Maybe we should do a feature on
I found it really hard to pick out particular instances, because they're all so positive.
I know, it's a pity that the thread's just going to fade away in the history of the site. I mean, it'll always be there, but you know, it's so significant.
Maybe we can put it up as this kind of sticky thing. People can keep adding their success stories, and they'll, you know, they'll go up into hundreds and hundreds of success stories.
That's a great idea.
Maybe we can turn it into a feature.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I would love that.
Dude.
Let's do it.
A positive community feature to make people feel good.
Let's do it.
Box out on action points, how to do it. Let's have it in next issue.
Okay.
Brilliant. Sounds like a fantastic idea.
Wow. Go, team.
Feel the power.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, that's a really great uplifting end to the podcast. The first time I think it's ever ended so positive.
Hang on.
Hold on, what's happening?
There is...
It's a...
One more thing. Back by popular demand, the 12 or so people who've left comments saying they really miss the one more thing.
They're the tip of the iceberg.
I think they are, yeah, there's a big silent majority out there who also love this. So I've got a test for you. I've got a really quick test, and you've got to answer as quickly as possible.
Disraeli.
All of you. Nope, so you're disqualified 52. Immediately from all future podcasts. Graham and Effie. All right, you can take part, Andrew. If we're thinking of Ubuntu letters...
Hang on, do I have to press a button?
Yes. Yeah. You have to make one and then press it. The next Ubuntu release is N, and then we're going to have O, blah, blah, blah. What version number is going to be the Ubuntu release that starts with Z? Quickly as possible.
Oh, God.
Don't calculate it.
1504.
Nope.
2104.
Nope. Effie?
50.3.
Nope. It's 17.04. So. I don't know who was closest, but probably not Effie. Effie's still living in the future with his bendable tablet.
I'm looking ahead.
Seasonal updates. By being wrong, Effie is right.
There you go.
Okay, that's brilliant. I mean, yeah, I think you should round it up.
Yeah, okay then. Well, that's it for this podcast. Tune in next 2 weeks and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. It's such a nice day.